Hey guys, horror fan here, and welcome back to my podcast on Anchor. Today, I'm gonna do the horror talk of Scott Lee Kimball. If you guys ever heard of him, or great for those of you who never heard of Scott Lee Kimball. Scott Lee Kimball, born September 21st, 1966. He's still alive. He is a convicted serial killer, con man, and fraudster from Boulder County, Colorado. He murdered at least 4 people over 2 years. Investigators strongly suspect him in as many as 21 other unsolved killings. For the first year of his murder activity, he worked as an informant for the FBI, which both paid him and protected him from facing justice over some of his fraud schemes. That's pretty crazy, honestly. Like a serial killer working as a working for the FBI. That's like, what the hell is going on right now? Almost none of the information he gave the Bureau was of any use in prosecuting other crimes, and much of it later proved false, so that's why he was a fraudster. The case greatly embarrassed the Bureau. The agent who oversaw him during this period was disciplined. He insists he was not the only one responsible for enabling Kimball. Kimball was sexually abused in his teens, which led to a suicide attempt and a life of crime. He is a skilled forger who, while he ran a legitimate business buying and selling organic beef, primarily enriched himself by passing bad checks on the accounts of others and using forged documents. By 2003, he had faced criminal charges in 4 Western states. These white-collar crimes also enabled his murders, allowing him to create evidence that his victims were still alive after he killed them. He also used their checking accounts and credit cards to further his schemes once they were dead. 2 of Kimball's victims were people close to him, the daughter of his third wife and his uncle. What the fuck? His second wife, who bore his 2 sons, claims he twice kidnapped her and raped her. There was an open arrest warrant for him from the second assault, which occurred after he absconded from work release. At the time, the FBI hired him as an informant. Kimball's family and some investigators believe that a 2004 motor vehicle accident that severely injured his oldest son was an attempt to kill the boy for insurance money. Charges were never brought due to conflicts between the jurisdictions where it could have been prosecuted. An investigation into a 2006 check fraud scheme eventually led law enforcement to discover the murders. Kimball, having violated the terms of his plea agreement when he could not lead police to the still missing body of one of the 4 victims, faced murder charges in all 4 cases. In addition to the fraud charges that had prompted the investigation, 3 of the missing fraud victims have been found in remote Colorado and neighboring Utah areas. Under Colorado laws, which quadruple sentences were for those found to be habitual offenders, he was sentenced to a combined 70 years for the frauds and the murders after pleading guilty. While in state prison, he additionally pleaded guilty to a charge of attempted escape. He is currently serving a sentence in federal prison at the United States Penitentiary Coleman in Florida. Damn, that's crazy. So he was born in Boulder, Colorado, U.S. He is 55 years old. He will be 56 next month. He had other names, Joe Snitch and Hannibal. Okay, that's nice. convicted of second degree murder, 4 counts, fraud, forgery, fraud, wait, again, fraud? Huh. Felon in possession of a firearm. Oh, okay, that's something. And attempted escape. Criminal penalty, 70 years, victims, 4 or more. Spent on crimes, 2003 to 2004, in the United States and Utah. He was apprehended on March 14, 2006. He is imprisoned at United States Penitentiary, Coleman, Sumter County, Florida. Before I get on to the horror talk of Scott Lee Kimball, don't forget to follow me on Anchor and Spotify. Let's get on to the horror talk. All right, early life. Kimball was born in Boulder, Colorado in 1966 when he was 10. His mother, Barb, became a lesbian. Oh, leading to his parents' divorce. His father, Virgil, left the state and remarried. Kimball was strongly affected by the divorce. In his early adolescence, he first encountered law enforcement when police were called to the house after he fired a gun out the window at neighboring houses. Oh, whoa, okay. I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't find any information between and his parents' divorce, including his, you know, his mother being a lesbian, but it's okay. Now the sexual abuse. So Kimball and his younger brother, Brett, took refuge at their grandmother's mobile home. A neighbor of hers, Theodore Payton, took advantage of their situation and began sexually abusing both of them at a cabin he owned in Netherlands. Payton's abuse progressed from having Kimball touch him and photographing the boy naked to tying Kimball up and raping him, recording the episode on him. Payton threatened to kill his father, who lived in Montana, if he told anyone. Payton continued abusing Kimball when Kimball will return to Boulder on weekends after he had moved to Hamilton, Montana, to attend high school and live with his father and brother. But the abuse ended when Kimball was 23. Oh my god. And he shot himself in the head in a suicide attempt. The bullet glanced off his skull, but the wound, which left a visible scar on his forehead, was severe enough that he was in critical condition for several days. But yeah, he miraculously survived that damn thing. Holy crap. A cousin, Ed Coet, remarked that Kimball came out of the experience as if he had, quote, lost his conscience, end quote. Afterward, Kimball and several other young men Payton had molested reported him to Boulder police. Payton was arrested, thank God, convicted of 7 counts of sexually assaulting a child and imprisoned. Kimball continued to feel a deep sense of shame, quote, less of a man, end quote, for it, according to a former girlfriend. Really? So Kimball wrote a letter to the judge begging him to sentence Payton to additional prison time, stating, quote, he has denied me my right to a normal, healthy, innocent childhood. He has damaged my life forever, end quote. When asked about the abuse and its effect on Kimball in 2010, Payton said only, quote, that was a long time ago, end quote. Now the criminal career. Kimball had already turned to nonviolent crime, usually a fraud. At 22, he was convicted of passing bad checks, his first felony, in Montana. Back in Colorado, he burglarized houses. Montana also charged him with running an illegal hunting outfitting business. A brief first marriage failed. In 1993, he married Larissa Hens and moved with her to Spokane, Washington, where they had 2 sons before divorcing in 1997, 25 years ago. She recalls that process servers were frequent visitors to their house, as Kimball was running scams in the logging industry, and those who partnered with him and were cheated would often use legal means to recover the money. Hence recalls, quote, he always had an excuse, it was never his fault, end quote. Among those Kimball victimized in his schemes were her dentists and the bishops at her church. Their relationship continued for another 2 years after the divorce, ending when Hens accused him of rape. Okay. Kimball told police she was trying to secure full custody of their sons, and no charges were filed after she failed a lie detector test. Prosecutors also saw the case as complicated, since the couple had continued to have consensual sex after the incidents. Okay. The following year, 2000, Kimball's probation violation for an earlier fraud conviction revoked his earlier suspended sentence and put him back in prison in Montana. A year later, he absconded from a halfway house and stole a truck and the till from his employer, a gas station, where he was on work release. Hens reported that shortly afterward, he returned to Spokane, where he broke into her house, kidnapped her, and raped her again. She filed charges and an arrest warrant was issued. not the cooperation with FBI, Kimball fled to Alaska, where he posed as his brother, got engaged to another woman, and resumed his career in check fraud, writing $25,000 in forged checks. He was again arrested and convicted. In federal prison, he convinced FBI agents that he would work for them as an informant. He was never brought on trial on the Spokane charges. The FBI denies this resulted from any intervention. The agent who handled Kimball in Alaska says he never knew about those charges. A fellow inmate, Arnold Flowers, was planning to have the federal judge and prosecutor in his case, along with the witness who had testified in the fraud case against him, killed. Kimball told the FBI, with his help and an undercover agent, the Bureau recorded Flowers and his girlfriend making the arrangements with persons they believed to be the killers. They were arrested on several felony charges in March 2002, 20 years ago. Kimball told the FBI he could help them with more cases. Another fellow inmate, he said, had boasted of having killed another federal prosecutor, Thomas Wales, in his Seattle area home the year before. Kimball was transferred to the low-security Englewood Federal Prison in Littleton, Colorado, outside Denver, for his safety. He discreetly let it be known that he had information about planned crimes that FBI agents might want to know about, and soon the Bureau's liaison to the prison, Carlos Shalav, came to visit him. Kimball told Shalav that former convict Steve Ennis, whom he had befriended, was allegedly plotting to kill witnesses expected to testify about Ennis's ecstasy distribution ring in an important trial. Shalav had resented being assigned to Englewood after earlier working on organized crime investigations. He considered the work more suited to a less experienced agent. In Kimball, he saw the possibility of breaking the kind of case that could put him back on the career path he had been hoping for. He viewed Kimball as a confident man who, while he, quote, had an answer for everything, end quote, was not violent and could still earn the trust of a jury as a witness. Due to Kimball's earlier service as an informant, there was nothing in his life about the rape and kidnapping charges. In March 2003, shortly after Jennifer Markham, the first of four people Kimball later admitted killing, disappeared, he pled guilty in a Colorado federal court to the Alaska fraud charges. The prosecution and defense agreed that the records would be sealed to protect Kimball's work as an informant, an agreement signed by John Suthers, U.S. Attorney for Colorado. The following day, the FBI flew him to Seattle for a monitored conversation with a man he had identified to Shalav as Wales' killer. But the conversation yielded no useful information on the case, as Kimball did not say what the FBI had wanted him to, and it seemed as if the man barely knew him. Afterward, Kimball failed a lie detector test in which he was asked if the man had confessed to Wales killing him. Federal prosecutors later told Shalav they were putting the Ennis case on hold. One Seattle agent sent Shalav an email about Kimball's poor performance and cast doubts on his credibility. Shalav angrily told the agent he should have shared his concerns in a phone call rather than an email, since anything written about Kimball by the FBI could be turned over to a criminal defense lawyer as part of discovery. And such an email by another FBI agent might undermine Kimball as a witness should it be introduced during a trial. He vouched for Kimball and remained confident enough in him that he did not bring up the email or the lie detector test at their next meeting. When Shalav drove Kimball to the airport the following month for a flight to Alaska to consult with prosecutors on the Flowers case, he noticed Kimball seemed less relaxed than usual, as if he were worried that Shalav knew nothing he was not telling Kimball about. When Shalav checked his online file at the FBI office afterward, he saw a new warrant from Spokane that did not specify a charge. Angry, and not just Kimball, but the prosecutors in the Ennis case and the Seattle agents who had doubted Kimball's reliability, Shalav decided to end Kimball's service as an informant. Ooh, that's not good. Schlaff had Denver police arrest Kimball upon his return from Alaska. The smoking charge turned out to be a minor violation of his probation related to his reporting of his address. Just after Schlaff told him he would no longer be an informant, Kimball told him he had information about the Jennifer Markham disappearance, which he later explained was evidence that Ennis's partner had killed Markham and told him about it in detail. A DEA investigator on the case was not sure Kimball was telling the truth, but he passed a lie detector test this time. At Kimball's sentencing in December, prosecutors told the judge that he might yet be able to help the Bureau solve that case and ask for the lightest sentence possible. Kimball was fined $5,000 and ordered to pay almost $8,300 in restitution to the Wells Fargo Bank branch in Cordova, Alaska. Judge Marsha Krieger sentenced him to 3 months in prison, which was more accounted for by the time Kimball served before his release. He was also put on probation for 3 years, ending his formal service as an FBI informant, although he could still work with the Bureau voluntarily. Krieger, largely bound by the terms of the plea agreement and the federal sentencing guidelines, nonetheless expressed some reservations. She contrasted Kimball's reticence about his finances, particularly recent payments from the FBI for his services, with his willingness to inform others. Krieger characterized that attitude as duplicitous, paraphrasing it as, quote, "I'm happy to turn other people in, but I don't want to be held fully accountable for my behavior," end quote. Since there was no precedent allowing her to refuse a downward departure from the guidelines in a case where the defendant had cooperated with the government, she granted it, reducing the sentence to time served. Murders. Following his 2002 release on a $10,000 bond, Kimball moved in with Barb and her partner. He began to make money by flipping houses and setting up an organic beef distribution company with $65,000 from his mother and brother. This business enterprise required him to frequently travel around the state to ranches and cattle auctions to buy products. His ex-wife had also returned to Colorado. She feared him but let him see his sons. The FBI also paid him the first installment of $50,000 and gave him a cell phone with an earpiece for recording. Over the next 2 years, Kimball killed four people, at least four that they later confessed to. Three of those four occurred while he was officially an FBI informant. Two of them were the girlfriends of Englewood inmates whom he befriended after his release. Another was his stepdaughter. Oh, the sole male victim was his uncle. Holy shit. He also allegedly attempted to kill his son, but no charges were filed in the incident due to legal complications. The body of his second victim, Jennifer Markham, has not been found. Oh, so here are the victims. First is Leanne Emery. At one of their early meetings, Kimball told Schlaff that Steve Hawley, another inmate he knew at Englewood, serving time for bank robbery, who had a history of escaping, was planning another attempt. Schlaff notified the prison, which put the man in solitary confinement. Kimball had initiated the plan, under which he would, once free, drive his truck to the prison wall, have others create a diversion, then throw a ladder over the wall, which Hawley would climb, and then the two would drive off towards Mexico. As part of the plan, Hawley directed Kimball to make contact with his girlfriend. Leanne Emery after his release. Likewise, he told Emery to do as Kimball told her to. An Idaho native had grown up in Colorado after her parents moved there. Emery, 24, had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder in her teens. She too worked as a stripper and had briefly married a Texas man who was incarcerated at the time, which led to her growing involvement with people involved in drugs and other crimes. Kimball reached out to her near the end of 2002, around the same time he was also meeting with Markham and began involving her in scams involving the theft of credit card related checks from mail thrown away by local post offices. Unable to confide in Holly since he had been put in solitary and could not receive or make phone calls, she clung more and more to Kimball, whom she admitted in an email to a cousin was, quote, dangerous, but if you don't fuck with him, he's your best friend, end quote. Damn, what the fuck? A week after writing that, on January 16, 2003, Emery returned to her parents' home in Santa and packed her car for what she said was a trip to Mexico to go caving, a hobby of hers. While her parents saw the trip as a hopeful sign that Leanne was finally moving on with her life, she showed them a childhood photograph of her in which she was visibly uncomfortable and told them that was how she felt at the time. Shortly after that, Emery phoned her sister to say just in case anything happened to her, to remember that she loved her. Instead of going to Mexico, she and Kimball spent the next week traveling through four different western states, stealing checks worth $15,000. They regularly charged their gas on their credit card. She also used it to buy a Toshiba laptop at Best Buy. On January 27, Emery called her parents to tell them that she was staying in Mexico a little longer. She was back in Colorado, and that was the last time they heard from her. Emery had been in the Denver area since she bought and mailed a gift certificate to her sister from there that same day. That night, she checked into a hotel in Grand Junction. A clerk there recognized her from a photo, but said later that her hair, long and blonde in the photo, had been cut short and dyed a dark color. From the hotel, she called a cousin. They talked for 2 hours, during which Emery said that if Kimball, for whom she used the alias Hannibal, learned of the conversation, he would kill both of them, although otherwise she was, quote, pretty safe, end quote. She could not say where she was, but claimed to be with some corrupt police officers. Emery ended the call with a reminder similar to the one she had left her sister, that if anything happened to her, she loved her. On January 29, she checked out of the hotel 2 days later. According to Kimball's later account, he drove with her into Bryson Canyon in Utah's Book Cliffs. Near the end of the road, Kimball asked her to go hiking with him. They went up a wash into a dead-end box canyon, then up a cliff face. Emery told him his face had just changed, and then he told her to take off her clothes and kneel on the rocks. Then he shot her in the head with a handgun she had brought for him a few days earlier during their crime spree. Damn. The day afterward, her abandoned car was found near the nearby town of Moab, 40 miles from Grand Junction. Her parents did not know anything was amiss until Holly wrote to them 2 weeks later, worried that he had not heard from Leanne in some time. Howard Emery, Leanne's father, wrote back that he and his wife had not heard from her and began investigating. Holly told him of an FBI agent who had been in contact with Leanne, but when Howard called the man, he said Holly was lying. Police were reluctant to investigate the case because Leanne was an adult who could make her own decisions, and Howard Emery says her background. Then Maurice tracked their daughter through her credit card records, learning she had never gone to Mexico. The cousin she had talked with before disappearing shared Leanne's emails, in which she repeatedly exposed fear of Kimball. Holly would not identify Kimball when asked, likewise warning Howard that if he did, that would put the entire Emery family's lives at risk. With some gas purchases, Leanne's credit card in California surfaced from the days after she had left Grand Junction. Howard regained hope that she was still alive. Oof. But when he saw copies of the receipts, he realized they were not her signature, but police still showed little interest in taking the case. Jennifer Markham. At another early meeting, Kimball told Schlaff that he had told Ennis that he would personally kill the witnesses against Ennis after his impending release. The next stop, Kimball said, was for Ennis's girlfriend, Jennifer Markham, to introduce him to Ennis's partner once he was out of prison. The partner would then give him the gun to kill the witnesses. Within 2 weeks of his release from Englewood, Kimball contacted Markham, a 25-year-old high school dropout who had moved to the Denver area with her young son from Illinois. Her career opportunities were limited. She was dancing at a strip club and living with her son's father in Colorado Springs. Oh, Kimball told her he owns some coffee shops in Seattle and that she should move there and manage one of them for him. Shalav would not let Kimball have sex with Markham when he asked about the complications it might cause should either of them eventually have to testify in court against Ennis or anyone else involved. When Markham told Ennis about Kimball, he suggested she take him up on his coffee shop offer and move to Seattle. It was the last he or anyone other than Kimball ever heard from her. At the dinner, as recorded by the FBI, Markham called one of the witnesses against Ennis a, quote, scumbag who deserved to die, end quote. The conversation went no further in that direction. Kimball told Shalav around the same time that shortly after the dinner, she had called and told him she was flying to New York, where Ennis had also been involved in drug distribution and worked as a stripper for a while. He claimed she had spent $600 to buy a revolver and killed Ennis's partner while she was there. Wow, damn. Shortly after their dinner, however, Markham moved all her belongings to Kimball's home in preparation for the move to Seattle. Shalav later found that both Markham and Kimball's cell phones normally were busy, showed no activity the next day. Kimball did not resume using his for another 3 days, and Markham never did. Parking records set at Denver International Airport show that Markham's green 1996 Saturn had been left there early on February 18. At the end of March, it was considered abandoned and towed for the unpaid fees. Two letters to her Colorado Springs address seeking payment went unanswered. Her son's father said she had not visited or made contact since she moved out. 2 months later, Shalav drove Kimball to a meeting with Ennis's drug partner, Jason Price, at a local chain restaurant. The agent asked if he had heard any news about Markham's whereabouts. Kimball said he had heard she was dead. This surprised Shalav, as while he was aware that Markham was associated with drug dealers and assumed some risks by doing so, he did not think getting killed would have been one of them. Kimball could not provide any further details when Shalav asked. Shalav recalled that he had been unable to reach Kimball the weekend Markham disappeared. All of Markham's furniture was also at Kimball's house, but he explained that by showing the agent a lease agreement signed by Markham, allowing him to use her furniture for a year in exchange for $400. I'm going to do part two. I'll be right back.